ultimately, what does the volcano say about God? And let's explore those things. There's the profile of the volcano before the eruption, the salt shaker view. Okay. There's the eruption, the profile after the eruption. The Bible says, "Come behold the works of the Lord who makes desolations in the earth." Psalm 46 verse 8. I take that scripture very seriously. What does that mean to me? That means put your boots on and get over there and see what happened. "Come behold the works of the Lord who has made desolations in the earth." There's the volcano before the eruption, 9,677 feet tall. It was a very beautiful, symmetrical profile volcano. There, directly north of the summit, is this beautiful lake. Let's see if I can do this. Yeah, here's the lake, Spirit Lake, north of the volcano. And there's all the forested slope. There's the volcano after the eruption. You see the lost 1,300 feet of summit elevation on the morning of May 18th as one half cubic mile of summit slid away in this gigantic landslide. The largest landslide observed in recorded history. It happened very abruptly at 8:32 in the morning on May 18, 1980. One quarter of the landslide material went down into Spirit Lake Basin, propelled the water of the lake up to 860 feet above the pre-eruption level. So the lake was shoved up onto the side of the mountain. As the lake sloshed back into the basin, it had a new landslide dam and a new debris deposit on the bottom, and was more than 200 feet above the pre-eruption level. 3/8 of a cubic mile of the landslide debris went down into the North Fork of the Toutle River and even overtopped Johnston Ridge here. And here you see some of the landslide deposits that spilled over a ridge. A 1,500-foot high ridge was overtopped by the landslide and avalanche material. And then that summit and north slope was like a giant cork holding down the pressure inside the volcano. And then what happened? Super hot liquid water inside the volcano flashed to steam, and we had a steam explosion equivalent of 20 million tons of TNT blast energy. The steam explosion did not blast up like we thought it might. It blasted northward over the landscape because the north side of the mountain had slid away. So it was a northward directed steam blast that leveled 150 square miles of forest in 10 minutes. Billions of board feet of timber. It was a colossal area that was devastated by the steam blast. Yet Mount St. Helens, from the standpoint of human experience and history, is just an average volcano as far as its size goes. But the unusual sequence of events was very extraordinary. There's a volcanic profile before the eruption. You see a summit crater. There was a little bit of steaming going on. This is 5 minutes before the volcano exploded. Here's a sequence profile morphed so you can see how the volcano collapsed from the northeast side. See the summit and north slope giving way. Then behind it, as the summit slid away over here in rotation, there was a big mass sitting there, and it uncorked the steam. Steam exploded from the summit, then exploded from the side, and it blasted out northward over the landscape. Equivalent to 20 million tons of TNT blast energy. That would be the 50 seconds of the first 50 seconds of the explosion, something like that. Here's a photograph that was taken 10 miles northeast of the volcano, looking at the volcano as it was slumping. You see this giant rotational mass in front. You can see the glacier ice streaming off. Everything was moving very rapidly. Then that's about 15 seconds after the explosion. By the way, there was an earthquake, magnitude 5.1 earthquake, that shook the mountain, and then the landslide debris slid. 8:32:17 is the time of the earthquake. So here it is, 8:32:35. So it's about 15 seconds, 17 seconds later. And then you can see how it deformed. Uncorked the bottle, and super hot liquid water flashed the steam. The steam explosion was severe. You can see how that streamed out. You can see blocks of summit in the steam explosion. Some of those are new islands in Spirit Lake. Okay, that's the size of that explosion. Yeah, here you see the streaming blocks blasting through the steam. There's the profile before the eruption. This is from the northwest, looking at the profile of the volcano. Notice this right here and this over here. The next photograph I'm going to show you is after the eruption from exactly the same place. Okay, that's before. Notice this over here and that over there. It's hard to tell if that's the same mountain. It's radically altered. Okay, there's that marker point over there, and there's the marker point over here. Notice the foreground, how it's much higher than the previous photo, and then notice the enormous crater. Before the eruption, it lasts 1,300 feet of summit. After. One more time. Before. See the foreground here and that ridge going down, and look at how low that foreland is after. So gigantic series of deposits there next to the volcano. Very interesting, and there's always something new to see. Here's a simulation of the first 50 seconds. Earthquake, magnitude 5.1. The summit gives way, rock slide, gigantic rock slide turns into a debris avalanche. A liquefied kind of flow that goes over the landscape. As it flows off the summit, the steam explosion occurs. Steam explosion. And then it's knocking down the forest. The supersonic blast jets over the top of the landslide material. And away from the base of the volcano, the supersonic blast knocks down the forest ahead of the debris avalanche. Isn't that an interesting thing? I know you want to see that again, right? Let's see if I can do that. I'll do that. Try to do that again. Okay, earthquake, debris avalanche, rock fall. The rocks falling at the summit. Then the simulation goes to the flow, the flowing debris off the summit, debris avalanche, that uncorks the steam explodes, the blast is directed as a jet, supersonic jet, over the top of the landslide debris, and then it, away from the volcano, knocks down the forest. First 50 seconds of the eruption. Okay, and there's the landscape after. Lost 1,300 feet of summit elevation. Spirit Lake was radically altered by the gigantic water wave in the lake. The lake sloshed back in its new basin with a landslide debris dam. All kinds of new avalanche material laying around on the landscape. And then after the first few minutes, then the volcano erupted vertically, that vertical eruption that we saw in the newspapers and on television during that time. And then the volcano erupted for 9 hours. That day, on May 18, 1980, the volcano released the energy equivalent of 440 million tons of TNT blast energy. 440 million tons of TNT blast energy is equivalent to 20,000 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs. And since there's 20,000 seconds in 9 hours, the 9-hour eruption was roughly an atomic bomb a second. That's a good way to remember what the volcano was doing in full eruption. During that 9-hour eruption, not just the earthquake, the steam explosion, and the avalanche, but the water wave on the lake, and then following that was the mud flows on the 6 major rivers around the volcano. And the whole landscape was devastated by pyroclastic flows, these flows from the summit of the and from the crater of the volcano. Mount St. Helens is just a small to average volcano compared to Yellowstone. You know, that last big eruption at Yellowstone was more than 2,000 times the explosion power of Mount St. Helens. On 6 major rivers downstream, major mud flows from Mount St. Helens. And mud flows caused more dollar damage from Mount St. Helens than the steam explosion. The steam explosion leveled 150 square miles of forest, but these mud flows went 50 miles away from the base of the volcano and did all kinds of damage downstream. Logging camps were overcome. Bridges were washed away on 6 major rivers. It was very severe. Well, let's take a look at some of the things the volcano did in very short order. Let's talk about stratification formed rapidly. It's almost a Ripley's Believe It or Not as you look at things out there. The pumice plain, directly north of the summit, right there on the south shore of Spirit Lake, that area was a site of intense activity. The intense activity was pyroclastic flows, especially on the afternoon of May 18, 1980. What's a pyroclastic flow? It is kind of a slurry of volcanic ash and steam that flows about 90 miles per hour coming down out of the crater at the volcano, and it slowed down and deposited these big lobes of volcanic ash. And here's the end of the pyroclastic flow. Every layer at Mount St. Helens has a date. Like, for example, we're looking at a cliff that's been exposed by erosion, and we're seeing what? The 9-hour eruption from May 18, 1980. There's the last hour or so of May 18, 1980. It's airfall tephra, if you want the technical term for it, airfall tephra. Then on as the volcano stopped, then the next event here is the June 12th, 1980 pyroclastic flow deposit. From 9 p.m. to midnight on June 12th, 1980, the radar from Portland indicated that the very dense volcanic ash sat above the crater for a period of about 3 hours. And during that 3-hour period, from about 9 p.m. to midnight on June 12, 1980, the volcano was collapsing in a series of volcanic ash flows or pyroclastic flows. So this 25 feet in thickness right here is the pyroclastic flow deposit from June 12, 1980, from between 9 p.m. and midnight. And so 3 hours it took to form that. Interesting. And look at the layering. I'll get back to that in a minute. Then on top of that sits the March 19th, 1982 mudflow deposit. There were mudflows not just on May 18, but through the period. And there was several major eruptions which created other eruptions that created mudflows. The mudflow of March 19th, 1982 filled in this area and spilled over a debris dam and created some interesting erosion structures. Take a look at the layered deposit from June 12, 1980. This is the upper half of the June 12, 1980 pyroclastic flow deposit. And the closer you get to it, the more layered it becomes. I had thought that layering would form slowly, like between summer and winter on the bank of a river, that type of thing. And I thought that a catastrophe would mix everything up. The coarse and the fine would be deposited together in a kind of massive deposit. Instead, it came out layered. Do you see that? The closer you get to the June 12th deposit, the more layered it becomes. Look at the layering there. And micro-thin layers form, of all things, in a hurricane. Something moving at 90 miles per hour. Okay, so my thoughts about stratification needed to be updated, let's put it that way. And how about Grand Canyon? You see the Tapete sandstone in the bottom of Grand Canyon, the layering in the Tapete sandstone. How long did that take to form? Well, the same kind of layering is seen in the pyroclastic flow deposits as in the at Mount St. Helens as in the cliff here at the Tapete sandstone in the bottom of Grand Canyon. So Grand Canyon layering may be explained very nicely by some of the events that we've seen at Mount St. Helens. How about erosion features formed rapidly? At the volcano, there was hard rock erosion. And up near the summit area, there were mud flows and landslides that came out of the crater, and it cut through solid rock. Here's an ancient lava flow, probably a 500-year-old lava flow. There's an ancient volcanic ash deposit that was gouged out after the summer of 1980 by these flows, flow process. And there you see a small stream flowing through that 100-foot deep canyon. Here's a deeper canyon up to 600 feet deep called Step Canyon, and it cut through an ancient lava flow, an ancient volcanic landslide deposit, and ancient volcanic ash layer. All that was gouged out after summer 1980. On March 19, 1982, there was a summit eruption behind a lava dome, and a small lake of water was displaced by that eruption, and there was a lot of summit snow in the crater that was melted by the summit eruption. And then what happened on March 19, 1982? Big mud flows downstream. One of the biggest mud flows events was from that displaced lake and all that melted snow in the crater on March 19, 1982. The mud flow came down into Spirit Lake, and it came down toward the west into the North Fork of the Toutle River. And it spilled into this basin made a whole new canyon system. The mud came down from the crater over on the upper right. The mud came down through here, reached through the up-warped landslide debris, and cut this canyon system. Another canyon comes in here. Five canyons come together. What an amazing place. The canyons come together, and the mud breached right through this area right here. It breached and then overtopped the lip of the pit here, and the spillover cut back, and it cut back a miniature Grand Canyon system. We were standing there looking on the ground, and we actually went to this location to film the documentary, Is Genesis History? We stood right up there with Del Tackett, and we were talking about the landscape. There's a little Grand Canyon you see off there. Notice the flat area north and south. Notice that the breach does not occur straight through. It has a snaky path. Notice the gully-headed side canyon and with cup-shaped side canyons, the amphitheater-headed side canyons. Those things are really interesting. And as we sat there in 1983-84 looking at this, we thought immediately of Grand Canyon. There's a miniature Grand Canyon, 1/40th scale. There's the cliff formed, and there's where the mud breached through. Here's the debris dam that was broken, and the new canyon system was formed. Now, if I'd not known about that mud flow and all that event at Mount St. Helens, here's what I might suppose. See that small stream flowing through that big wide canyon? How long would it take that small stream to form that big wide canyon? It might appear to require thousands of years for that to happen. Of course, it didn't happen that way. It happened rapidly. That's the story at Mount St. Helens. Here's a canyon called Engineer's Canyon, new canyon formed by drainage. There's a man up on that slope, top of that for scale. So that's a 140-foot tall cliff there. And do you think that that canyon was eroded by that small stream, one sand grain at a time? It may appear that way. And so what Mount St. Helens does is it challenges our way of thinking about erosion of canyons. For example, Grand Canyon. Here's a Landsat image of Grand Canyon. Grand Canyon is 4 to 18 miles wide. Total length of Grand Canyon is about 257 miles long, mile deep. And look, it cuts through the highland area there in northern Arizona. It is kind of the river canyon that goes over the top of a hill. Most geologists have jettisoned the idea that Grand Canyon was cut by the Colorado River over tens of millions of years. But that's the myth that we hear in our culture, right? The myth is countless millions of years for the Colorado River to slowly cut the Grand Canyon as the plateau land was slowly uplifted since the time of the dinosaurs, maybe 50 to 70 million years ago. Well, how did the Grand Canyon form? I like the idea that Grand Canyon formed by catastrophic breaching of a dam. One of the explanations that geologists is now considering. Take a look at the profile of Mount St. Helens, a canyon right here. See the small meandering stream in the U-shaped canyon. See the upland area, 180 feet of relief across there. Here's 4,000 feet of relief in the U-shaped canyon in Grand Canyon. We're over the spillover points looking directly downstream. So Grand Canyon and Mount St. Helens have similarity. Mount St. Helens and Grand Canyon are evidence of spillway erosion from spillover, the spillover process, I believe. And so Mount St. Helens helps us understand the terrain at Grand Canyon and elsewhere, of course, but certainly challenges us to think that way. How about logs and log deposits at Spirit Lake? Let's talk about those. I was sitting down next to the lake one day eating my lunch, considering the volcanic process that was going on, and I see these four sticks float in. You see the four sticks? And they float in with their upper part above the water, but the lower part was floating underwater, and those upright floating sticks grounded in the shallow water area and became lodged there. And I thought about the floating sticks. If the sticks could float like that, how about the logs on Spirit Lake? Could the logs on Spirit Lake float prone like this? Then one end could be water-soaked and float upright, I thought to myself, and the logs could become upright floating log. Then what could happen? The whole log could become heavier than water and sink, but the upper part would still be floatable and so buoyant, and so it would be an upright deposited log, I thought. Then what could happen? Well, the logs could fall over and be buried, or they could fall out at different times and have their root ends buried at different strata layer levels in the bottom of the lake. That's an interesting idea as I was sitting there eating my lunch watching those floating sticks in the lake. But how about the logs in the lake? A million logs floated in Spirit Lake north of the volcano after the eruption. Notice how they float prone, and some of the logs float upright. You can see them occasionally in there. And over at the edge of the lake, you can see the upright floaters. Man-made lowering of the lake has slightly inclined those logs, but those were upright floated logs that grounded in that shallow water area. And so how would we verify that the logs were floating in upright position and falling to the bottom of the lake? what would we do? We thought about it and we said, let's get a sonar device into Spirit Lake. And so we got a boat into Spirit Lake with automobile batteries, the sonar recorder, and the large towfish. The towfish you lower over the side of the boat, and that sends out the signal and reads the reflection off the bottom of the lake. And the sonar record is very interesting. Here we're looking at the sonar record. Here's the towfish position at the bottom. The towfish position. You see open water below the towfish, and there's the bottom of the lake directly underneath the boat. And then as we're looking out about 25 to 50 yards over the bottom of the lake. You can see the topography of the bottom of the lake. What is interesting about this is look at this. There's an upright reflector right here standing off the bottom of the lake. And notice this, a shadow behind it, a sonar shadow of an upright object. And it's casting a shadow 20 or 30 yards over the bottom of the lake. There's an inclined reflector standing off the bottom of the lake. The inclined reflector has an inclined shadow behind it. You see that? And then over here there's an enormous sonar shadow, a little bit off the bottom. And then you see there's a sonar reflector standing off the bottom. And then you see the sonar shadow behind it. It even seems to have outflaring root mass. Looks like a big base of a trunk of a tree that's just been replanted there. What do you think about the sonar imagery that we were getting back from Mount St. Helens? When we did the sonar study in 1984 and 1985, we estimate something like 10,000 upright objects were standing on the bottom of the lake. What would the lake look like if you drained it? It would look like a forest of trees that was there. But those trees did not grow on the bottom of the lake. They have been replanted there. So are you interested in what I did next, how I was thinking? Okay, I think you can think about what I was thinking about. Okay, you're anticipating what next. But how would you verify the sonar is indeed giving us the correct impression of the bottom of the lake? So there I am. There's my diving buddy, and we're getting ready to go dive in Spirit Lake next to the active volcano. Okay, how many times do you get to be decked out in your dive gear with the active volcano behind you? Okay, that's a picturesque event. Anyway, the logs are all around on the shore of the lake, and they're floating there in the lake. Notice this upright floating log in the lake. There's the steaming lava dome in the background for added realism as we're scuba diving in the lake. Underneath the log mat, you can see looking up with the underwater camera, you're looking up at the log mat, you can see 6 foot to 8 foot diameter Douglas fir logs right there floating in the lake. And here we are underneath the log mat. From under the log mat, it's very interesting. As you look down on top of the log mat, you can't see the upright floaters very easy because just the top of the log is sticking out of the water. But from underneath, the upright floater logs hang down from underneath the floating log mat. You see this amazing thing. There's a big log that's standing there. Doesn't have root mass associated with it, so it's a broken timber that's sitting there. And there's two more upright floaters underneath the log mat. On the bottom of the lake, right where the sonar said they would be, we saw and found upright floating and deposited logs. There's a base of a tree that had been landed there. There's another log sitting right here embedded in the bottom of the lake. With my diving buddy, we got on both sides of this log, and we could not dislodge the log. It had fallen in vertical position and become solidly embedded in the bottom of the lake. Other logs had recently landed. You could see their outflaring root mass. They could be easily tipped and swayed. So the the logs tell an interesting story on the bottom of the lake. There was a sign at Yellowstone National Park describing the fossil forests at Yellowstone. The sign at Yellowstone said this: across the valley rise the slopes of Specimen Ridge, but the forest you see there today is only the latest chapter in a remarkable story. Buried within the volcanic rocks that compose the mountain are 27 distinct layers of fossil forests that flourished 50 million years ago. The right side of the sign tells you detail about it. Many stumps still stand upright in the same sites where they grew millions of years ago. 27 different layers with upright logs certainly must represent multiple forests in millions of years. I went to the ranger that was in charge of that sign, and I asked the ranger, "What about that sign there at Specimen Ridge?" And the ranger said, "That sign has become very controversial. I can't find two geologists that agree on the content of the sign." And I said, "Well, would you like to receive some information on why the sign became so controversial? Mount St. Helens may have created what's right there and done it recently." And sure enough, the sign all of a sudden left. Okay, it was no longer there. And there's a blank area there. The sign was not replaced. And the fossil forest interpretation is no longer favored by the National Park Service there. Although many might think about it, but there you see the volcanic strata at Specimen Ridge, and there's layers of volcanic ash and flows that are in there, and in there is where we find the very beautifully agatized and petrified logs. Here are sequoia logs standing vertical out of the deposit. There's another one over there, and there's the modern forest growing there today. What more natural thing to think about than, oh, there's the modern forest growing there today. There's the ancient forest that grew there in 27 different levels, multiple forests over what? Millions of years. And so the story gets told, but it needs to be reinterpreted. We dug out the roots of many of these logs. They often terminate abruptly about 3 feet from the base of the trunk of the tree. There's no soil profiles in there. There's all kinds of interesting arguments or evidences that those trees have been replanted in vertical position. Also, dendrochronology, a correlating tree ring sequence, has been obtained from logs with the root ends buried at different strata layer levels, apparently proving that the fossil forest interpretation is wrong, that logs with the root ends that buried at different levels grew at the same time, which is crazy, but you want to think about it. And so Mount St. Helens may have helped us reinterpret the petrified forests and petrified log deposits elsewhere. Well, how about the peat deposits of Spirit Lake? We'll talk about peat and coal. Let me talk to you first about coal. Coal is that hard, black, compact rock that is very beautiful. You see in close-up, you can see the detail, what looks like glassy bands running through coal. The layered appearance of coal, especially evident. And that's an argument for what? Tree bark in coal. I was looking at a lump of coal one day and thinking about the tree bark that was very abundantly preserved in it. There were lots of glassy sheets running through it, horizontal through the coal beds, and that's the general appearance of coal. And I was thinking about the normal interpretation or conventional interpretation for coal. You know the conventional interpretation. Coal forms in large freshwater swamps. You've been taught that in school, right? Forms in large freshwater swamps by buildup of plant material over long periods of time, like thousands of years. It builds up slowly. The antiseptic waters of the swamp prevent complete bacterial decay of the of a material, unlike Okefenokee, for example, or down in the Everglades, that kind of thing, this peat builds up. And it builds up a thick spongy layer and later gets buried by mud or sand or something from somewhere else. And then some other deposit is formed. Well, take a look at a drained swamp deposit along the coast of Nova Scotia. Coastal erosion has drained the swamp, and you see the plant material, which is built up over hundreds of years there in that swamp. And what are those large objects hanging out of there? Those are roots. Modern swamp peats are intensely root penetrated and create this rather homogeneous coffee grounds to mashed potatoes kind of texture intruded by roots. And the rooted nature of modern peats is severe and very obvious. And then I was thinking about the coal beds where the bark is sitting in there very parallel to the direction of the coal. So one day, it was the day before Christmas, 1978, in Penn State University in State College, Pennsylvania, I was taking a bath, thinking about the root-penetrated nature of modern peats, and I was thinking about the layers of bark sheet that are very obvious in coal, when I thought of a different model for how coal could form. Coal could form from large floating log mats. Okay, and so I sketched this theory, and the theory of floating mat model for the origin of coal. I imagined a large floating mat could even be living trees in the floating log mat, and underneath that floating log mat, there's open water, and broken material could break off from a wave disturbance of the log mat. Bark could be peeled off. It could fall to the bottom and make a large deposit of peat underneath a floating log mat that was not rooted like modern swamp peats are. And so the floating mat model for the origin of coal was an afterthought, thinking about the rooted nature of modern peats and the layered appearance of coal. Well, in summer of 1979, I defended my PhD dissertation on the floating mat model for the origin of a coal bed in western Kentucky. The Kentucky number 12 coal bed that I studied looks like it formed underneath a floating log mat, and that's why I needed an explanation for the floating log mat model for the origin of coal. That was in the summer of 1979. What happened 10 months later? 10 months after I turned in my PhD dissertation on the floating mat model for the origin of coal, Mount St. Helens exploded and made a gigantic bathtub full of floating logs. And I had to go diving at Spirit Lake to see what it was like there north of the volcano. And notice something about the logs. The logs are floating there, but they don't have bark. The conifer bark is peeled off. It swells and peels off. And where did it go? Good observational skills. You want to think about those. On the bottom of the lake, right where underneath the log mat, we see sheets of tree bark laying on the bottom of the lake. About 25% of the material laying on the bottom of the lake when I did that study was sheets of tree bark, other broken plant material associated with it. So could I have seen the first step for the formation of a coal bed there on the bottom of Spirit Lake? Yeah. Okay. And so the floating mat model has a modern analog in the floating logs at Spirit Lake. So a new theory for the origin of coal from studying things at Mount St. Helens. Before I finish, I want to talk to you about the life flourishing in the blast zone at Mount St. Helens. After the eruption, I was out there in the blast zone at Mount St. Helens in the closed area, and other biologists were in there, and they were talking about the plants that were regrowing. And on sterile volcanic ash, all these plants started to grow. Just a few years after the eruption, the plants started growing. Fireweed, pearly everlasting, all of these plants. Conifer seedlings were buried in snowpack. They were bent over and buried in snow. They were just 6 inches or so high. The steam blast went over the top of them. Because they were packed in ice, they survived, and they regrew. And the tree seedling conifers were growing there. And then gophers single-handedly churned up the volcanic ash and brought the seeds to the surface. And so the whole blast zone was reseeded by pocket gophers that brought the seeds to the surface. And then all kinds of things happened, like the pearly everlasting and fireweed coming in. And then the elk came in. The elk came in, and they were very interested in the habitat. We thought that elk were a forest-dwelling animal. They did wonderful there at Mount St. Helens. Notice all the grass that's growing around on the slopes? They love grass, don't they? Now, we thought that elk were forest-dwelling animals. There are more elk in the blast zone than are in the forest around the blast zone. They prefer the open terrain. Now, biologists were saying, this is a terrible place for elk because they'll get overheated from the sun. They can't find shade. And look at this. They're laying down in the wet soil in the middle of the day. They're taking a siesta, and they know how they have a cooling behavior. And they're able to survive just nicely in the blast zone, even in spite of what the scientists were saying about the elk. And the elk are having a good time out there with all of that. What does that help me understand? That helps me understand what it was like after Noah's flood. Okay, animals and plants disperse widely over the earth after the flood, and so the survivors from the ark were able to colonize the new landscape. Along with the seeds that were floated through the flood, the whole landscape was re-inhabited. Mount St. Helens provides a miniature laboratory for understanding how animals and plant ecology can be reconstructed after a catastrophe. Well, we've talked about some of the major things a volcano has done in very short order, and we've talked about a little bit about the application of what Mount St. Helens to other geologic features. Now let's talk about what the volcano says to you and me personally. You know, the humanist, the person who believes that he's the master of his own destiny, the humanist is humbled because what? There is power not under man's control. Somebody else is in control. Who is in control? God. God is in control. And it's stated in Scripture. He looks at the earth and it trembles. He touches the mountains and they smoke. Psalm 104, verse 32. He looks at the earth and it trembles. He touches the mountains and they smoke. God reached down with a little finger and touched Mount St. Helens. 400 million tons of TNT blast energy in his little finger. And that's just a small, the average volcano. There have been a lot bigger volcanoes in human history. So Mount St. Helens is just a starting point to start talking about volcanic power. Incredible power in the volcano. And as we start thinking about the volcano, I start thinking about who's in control. God is in control. And then I think about myself, how small I am and rather insignificant related to that great power. And I think about Jesus. Jesus came to serve me at my point of need. He let aside that power that he had as creator, and he came to serve me at my point of need. He died as a substitutionary atonement for sin on the cross. And then the Bible goes on to say that God has highly exalted him. He humbled himself, became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. God has highly exalted him, given him a name above every name, the name of Jesus. Every knee should bow and tongue confess that Jesus is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. You may remember Harry Truman. He was a, 80-year-old curmudgeon there north of the volcano. His lodge was directly north of the volcano on the south shore of Spirit Lake. He refused to leave. The United States Geological Survey said, "Harry, we want you to leave. This volcano could explode." He said, "No, it's not going to explode. I've been living here all my life." And he saw the summit eruptions. He felt the earthquake. And then on the morning of May 18, he was buried underneath the volcanic ash debris and died with his whole lodge and home being buried. That he kind of stands for 20th century man, doesn't he? We stand and we think, oh no, we're not responsible to God's law, and we kind of ignore the warning signs. But Mount St. Helens provides an instructive example. That day, on the morning of May 18th, 1980, the volcano released the energy equivalent of 440 million tons of TNT blast energy. 20 million tons just in the steam explosion. Over the 9-hour eruption, 440 million tons of TNT blast energy. That's an atomic bomb a second for 9 hours. And that's the volcano, a small volcano in full eruption. And we've seen an amazing demonstration of volcanic power right in our lifetime. The volcano did some things in very short order. I believe it's the geologic event of the 20th century. And I would call it the Rosetta Stone. Call it a Rosetta Stone. You know what the Rosetta Stone is? That's an artifact that was found in Egypt. It was sculpted in about 200 B.C. and it was found dating from about 190 B.C. It has three translations, Latin, Greek, and cuneiform. We would not know about the Egyptian cuneiform language and been able to interpret the Egyptian civilization without knowing their language, except for the Rosetta Stone. That provided the key. And Mount St. Helens is a Rosetta Stone. It helps us understand catastrophist geology. Mount St. Helens is a Rosetta Stone for deciphering global catastrophic process that the Bible says formed the earth. Think about global flood during Noah's day and think about the application of what Mount St. Helens has told us. Thank you so much.